Welcome to the NewsHour. 5 weeks into the war, Ukraine says Russian forces are withdrawing from the north and areas around the capital. It includes Hostomel. That's where Russian troops seized an airport in the first few days of the invasion. Now, troops are also leaving the northern city of Chernihiv after shelling it for days. Russia has pledged to reduce its operations in those areas during negotiations in Istanbul taking place this week. And further virtual talks between the warring sides are set to get underway in the coming hours. Now, the Red Cross is leading an evacuation of civilians from Mariupol on Friday, but it's unsure if aid can be delivered. Around 160,000 people remain trapped in the besieged port city with little food, water or shelter. We'll be going live to Hashem Halbara from Moscow in a moment. But first, let's bring in Rob McBride, who's joining us from Lviv in western Ukraine. So Ukrainian officials are saying that Russian forces are withdrawing from several areas north of Kyiv. How is this withdrawal being explained, Rob?
That's right. We're getting reports from a number of different locations, cities and towns, all between this the area of fighting, basically the northern front between Kyiv and the border with Russia. The authorities in the capital, Kyiv, say that some places on the outskirts of the city, such as Irpin and Brovary, these are places that have seen a lot of the intense fighting in recent weeks. The troops, Russian troops, have been withdrawing their units from there. Also, Gostomel, this is the location of a very important airport facility and a military facility just to the northwest of Kyiv. Now, this was taken by Russian paratroopers. You'll remember in the very first day or so of the conflict, it was retaken with a counterattack by the Ukrainians. Gradually, as the Russians advanced, they took this airport again. Well, now footage has emerged on social media, drone footage showing a very deserted airport, but very badly damaged facility, but the Russians having left from there. Also from Chernihiv, this is a city very close to the Russian border. The governor of that city says that not only have Russians pulled back from the city, but also out of the region as well, he says. So it does seem as though the Russians are withdrawing units. They said they would do. They said they would be concentrating on the east of the country. It's difficult to tell exactly what these units are going to do now. It does look as though they are being reorganized, regrouping, replenished. You'll remember some of these units have actually been out in the field living under camp. For months. They were on supposed exercises in Belarusia and in Russia itself from last November, December. So they would be in need of replenishment, of new recruits joining the ranks, of being regrouping and waiting to see what they do. But of course, the fighting still as intense in the east of the country and also down in the south around Mariupol.
So, and speaking of Mariupol, how are efforts going to get people out of the besieged port city?
It has been problematic, to say the least, to try to get the two sides to agree to a ceasefire, to allow this humanitarian corridor to be set up. They have been trying now for a couple of days, but according to the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, the two sides have agreed just today, Friday, to set up finally this ceasefire to allow the convoy to get in. The Ukrainians have sent down towards the city now 54 buses, which it's hoped will basically form the most of the convoy to bring aid into the city, but also bring people out, many of the thousands who are desperate to get out. The Ukrainians also hope that other private vehicles and cars will be allowed to join this convoy to go along the coast to Berdyansk, which is a city that's controlled by the Russians, but then head north into Ukrainian territory. But it remains to be seen just when that will happen. The latest we are getting from the deputy mayor of Mariupol is simply, until now, it has simply been too dangerous for anybody to try to leave the city, also accusing the Russians in the last couple of days of stopping even small amounts of humanitarian aid getting into Mariupol.
All right, thank you so much. Rob McBride reporting from Lviv in western Ukraine. Now, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned Russia is consolidating and preparing powerful strikes in the country's east and south. Russian forces have faced tough resistance in their battle for Kharkiv, the second biggest city in the country. This report by Esad Beg contains distressing images from the start.
There's only death here. Bodies of young Russian soldiers lying unclaimed. Apparent victims of poor tactics, or so the Ukrainians tell us.
It was very intensive fighting. Our guys had high morale. A special operation was planned together with the 92nd Brigade. They flanked this position and then cleared it.
The Russians had poor defensive positions, say their enemies, exposing them to Ukrainian artillery.
This was a Russian defensive line. All along here, you have what's left over of this intense battle. Burnt out tanks, weapons left behind, grenades. They didn't even have time to take some of their dead.
Everywhere we look, there are signs of battle. And fear of chemical attack. Ukrainian soldiers salvage what's left. The village of Malorohan is back under Ukrainian control, but the cost has been high. A fierce battle pushed the Russians away from the gates of Kharkiv. 21-year-old Yevgeny has been awarded Ukraine's highest honor for destroying 5 tanks and other heroics during battle. He tells us it's the first time he's come across the use of phosphorus, the highly flammable chemical.
It was my first experience with phosphorus. Airstrikes were not as scary as the phosphorus. First they used the airstrikes, then the phosphorus. My eyes were burning, I couldn't breathe through my nose. It was like really difficult to breathe. The equipment was burning, it was bad.
We can't independently verify its use.
This was one of the main streets in this village, and it's completely destroyed. Every building, every window, everything that you see has some sort of damage. There's bullet holes in the doors, the windows have been blown out, there's bricks all over the place. And we've been told that we can only stick to this main road because everywhere around hasn't been completely demined, because the fear is that the Russians have left mines and booby traps behind for the Ukrainian soldiers taking this place. But as you see, there's not much left. Assad Beg, Al Jazeera, outside Kharkiv.
An oil depot in the Russian city of Belgorod on the border with Ukraine is on fire. The city's governor says Ukrainian military helicopters attacked it, but Kyiv has not claimed responsibility. An ammunition depot near Belgorod caught fire on Wednesday. Rania Dridi has more from Belgorod in Russia.
Previously, there were some incidents where Ukrainian shells fell over some villages in Belgorod region, but Russia says this is the first time an oil facility has been targeted. The governor says 2 Ukrainian helicopters penetrated the Russian airspace without being noticed by the air defense systems and targeted an oil tank. Fires are still blazing at the oil facility, and the Russian Ministry of Emergency announced that the firefighting operations are still ongoing, with around 200 fighters using about 60 special units to fight the fires. All the people in the area have been evacuated. Also, the Russian Ministry of Emergency has mentioned that they fear the fires can spread to 8 oil containers. The mayor of Belgorod region denied the news that 2 people have been injured and received the necessary treatment. So firefighting operations are still going on, and so as to prevent any fire spread to other oil containers and tanks.
We'll bring in Hashem Halbara. He's joining us from Moscow to tell us what officials are saying about that incident in Belgorod, Hashem, and also the state of peace talks.
Well, Darin, the governor of Belgorod is saying that the helicopters involved in the attacks were flying at low altitude and they targeted the fuel depot in Belgorod, which is on the border with the Ukraine. The authorities are saying that they are making all the necessary efforts to ensure there's no disruption of fuel in the area at the same time. In the first reaction, the Kremlin said that the attack on Belgorod is not going to be helpful in the talks with Ukraine. And as far as those talks are concerned, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov from India said that there's a progress in those talks and that Russia is working on a response to the proposals made by the Ukrainians, insisting at the same time that the Ukrainians understand now the status of both Crimea and Donetsk and Luhansk. As far as Crimea is concerned, you remember, Darin, the Russians have been insisting One of the key elements of the deal is for the Ukrainians to recognize Crimea as Russian and also recognize both self-declared republics of Luhansk and Donetsk. But it remains to be seen how talks will further evolve, particularly when it comes to other issues, particularly when it comes to the security arrangements that Ukraine has been asking for, something similar to the NATO's collective defense mechanism and the role that the key guarantors will be playing to in the future to secure and to the security of Ukraine. Lavrov has also been saying that the West and NATO were trying to use Ukraine as a front to further undermine the stability in Russia. And now that Russia is sending a clear message, they cannot tolerate this to happen. And this, he says, this explains why we're launching this special operation in the Ukraine.
And of course, Hashim, the other big headline is that the deadline for countries to pay for Russian gas in rubles, that deadline is today. What's happening with that?
Well, today the Russian energy company Gazprom said that it sent messages to the main suppliers, the contractors, asking them to start paying in the local currency, the ruble. And Sergei Lavrov, when he was asked about this particular question about the new rule, which is has been implemented, which asked all the suppliers to be accepted in ruble, he said that his country has been attacked economically by the West and by the Americans, and that they have been imposing sanctions, and that it's about time for Russia to create its own mechanisms to protect its own economy and shield itself from any further repercussions from the impact of those sanctions. And he said that this is why we are now asking all those countries to pay in ruble. He further elaborated on what is widely seen as a Russian perspective when it comes to this whole issue. He said that the U.S. in particular wants to impose a world order dominated by the U.S., where the euro, where the dollar and then the euro are the key currencies. No, as far as Russia is concerned, it wants to also ensure that its local currency is a key global currency in global trade. And I think the Russians have been saying so far that they are adamant they will have to go forward with the need for all those companies to pay them in rubble.
Okay, thank you so much, Hashim Halbara, reporting from Moscow. We'll continue this conversation and speak to Chris Weefer, who's the chief executive officer of Macro Advisory, a strategic consultancy focused on Russia and Eurasia, joining us from London. Welcome to Al Jazeera. So Gazprom at the heart of this, but is this more about protecting it from future sanctions than it is depriving Europe of gas?
Yeah, it's exactly right. This is, to some extent, is a little bit cosmetic, because the actual procedure that's changing requires the gas customers in Europe to pay into Gazprom Bank in dollars or euros as per the existing contract. And then Gazprom Bank will convert that money into rubles for onward transmission to Gazprom. So the only change that's been made today is that there's now a new kind of intermediary bank, Gazprom Bank, in the payment process. But for European customers, they'll still pay in euros and dollars. And the reason Russia has done this, it possibly is a move towards eventually moving everything to a ruble contract, but this is not the case. Right now, this pretty much ensures that Gazprom Bank cannot be sanctioned because, of course, the critical issue for the Russian economy is that it is able to not only export key commodities like gas, but also that it can be paid for it and can bring that money back to Moscow. Therefore, it needs at least one big bank to remain able to use the global SWIFT payment system. And Gazprom Bank is one of those banks. And it now means that it's pretty much fireproof, if you like, from being included in future sanctions, because that would automatically then lead to a default in the payment system.
So how likely is it that European countries actually pay in rubles?
Well, no, they don't have to pay in rubles. They pay into Gazprom Bank in dollars or euros, and then Gazprom Bank will take care of the conversion. So they do not. This is not a move to ruble payments as such by the customers. It simply puts an intermediary bank in the system, that then pays Russia in rubles. But the customer will continue to pay in euros or dollars, and that's being confirmed by President Putin and by both Chancellor Scholz and the Italian Prime Minister, who said that they've had confirmation from President Putin. So it is a kind of a change in the payment system, but it is not a move to rubles yet. We're a long way off that.
We did hear, however, about 24 hours ago from the German Chancellor, who called this political blackmail.
Well, it is to the extent that now Europe cannot really sanction Gazprom Bank, and therefore they cannot cut Russia off from the global financial system. Because if they were to sanction Gazprom Bank, then it means that Germany or other European countries could not pay for their gas, and therefore they would disrupt the contract and lead to gas disruption. So to that extent, it does raise the stakes. And it means that, you know, Europe pretty much has to now treat Gazprom Bank separately. Otherwise, they could run the risk of gas disruption. So it does raise the stakes, but it is not what we originally were told, which is that customers would have to pay rubles into Gazprom today. That's not the case. They pay their foreign exchange into Gazprom Bank, who then does conversion for them. It makes Gazprom Bank more important for the Russian payment system and also for Europe's energy security.
Understood. So just on the issue, though, of gas disruption, I mean, there had been some speculation up to this point that could Russia actually turn off the taps to Europe? Is that likely at this point?
I would say no, not at all, because remember, Russia is just as dependent on the money it receives for exporting the gas as the European customers are for their energy needs. So this would be a mutually destructive move by Russia. And there's no indication that Russia is planning that. They are certainly playing clever, as it were, with regard to the payment system to try and protect Gazprom Bank, to try and protect the one Russian bank in the SWIFT system. But there is no indication whatsoever that Russia is planning on disrupting export flows. Despite everything that's happening at a political level in Ukraine, Russia has been very consistent in its position that it would always honour foreign contracts, provided the counterparty does the same. So Russia says it will not be the one to break the contract. It is kind of tailoring the contracts, but it said it'll never break it. So there's no indication whatsoever that Russia is planning to cut off any energy supplies or other material supplies to the West, so long as they can get paid for those exports.
And just looking at sort of the bigger picture and the price of crude oil, it has been inflationary over the past couple of months, as you know. How much pressure do you think there is on other oil-producing nations to turn up their oil productions?
Well, clearly, there's a lot of pressure from the consuming countries to do so, on OPEC countries in particular. But do bear in mind that the OPEC Plus group has been struggling to actually meet their production targets anyway. They have not. They took a long time, for example, to raise production to the January agreed levels, and since then have been falling well short. Now, of course, countries like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates do have spare capacity, but they seem unwilling to move too quickly because, remember, they're now finally making a lot of money running budget surplus based on the current oil price. Those countries have been running budget deficits for years with lower oil price and only now have sort of moved back into a budget surplus. So they're not willing to jeopardize that to do anything that could collapse the price and therefore bring them back into a budget deficit situation. So it's not surprising, therefore, that the OPEC countries that have capacity are unwilling to turn that tap on at this stage. We, of course, have the announcement from the US that they're going to tap in strategic reserves. But really, that's not going to make much difference. As you see in the oil price, it's still holding well above $100 because the strategic reserve release in the US only covers the amount of oil that the US is now banning from Russia, approximately million barrels a day. So it doesn't really, it only covers that missing oil. It doesn't really add any extra oil into the global system. So right. In that sense, the move yesterday shouldn't disrupt the oil price, and that's what the oil market is telling you today.
Thank you so much, Chris Weaver, for breaking it all down for us from London.